infrastructure lacking. Okay, so how does that affect its action? Decrease solubility, that's why this one has very low water solubility properties because of that. And these electrons get easily delocalized into the room, into the ring, so that's why it's a very weak base. But you see this in a lot of over-the-counter products. Very low toxicity, works, it's widely used, not a very potent though for the reasons we just talked about. And it's hydrolyzed to PABA, so you've got to be careful about sensitivities with people. You also have to be careful about people that might be on sulfonamides. Remember, we talked about that. Okay, did I start talking about the vasoconstrictors? Yeah? Okay, so remember last time we talked about how you can apply tourniquets to areas of the body, and what does that affect, or what effect does that have when you use a local anesthetic? Is it what? Decreases side effects because why? Right, it can't dissipate into an area, right? And you're also, you're keeping the blood flow very restricted, right? So you don't have to give as much, and it works really well. However, they figured out that they can just mix, like adrenaline, for example, or epinephrine, into these local anesthetics, and it will, in essence, create or cause pretty much the same effect. And so that's what's commonly used today. What types of, and you can do the same thing, you won't have to add as much, etc., because all your local anesthetics will have some sort of vasodilative properties, and that's what leads to their shorter duration of action. We have ones that are more intermediate, long duration, but you still have to worry about the vasodilative properties. What types of patients might you not want to see being given a local with a vasoconstrictor? Right, people that have very high blood pressure, cardiac issues, stuff like that. So they're going to be more in the higher risk. You have to outweigh, benefit outweighs the risk for using it and how high risk they would actually be. And make sure you just pay attention to other options. We're going to talk about a couple of local anesthetics that cause less vasodilative effects, so you can actually give them without a vasoconstrictor. So there are advantages because our body already synthesizes adrenaline, right? So it's an endogenous molecule, so we don't have to worry about a lot of complications using this. Okay, so the first safe substitute, if you will, for a local anesthetic outside of, because they were trying to move away from cocaine, came with this molecule here. So what type of molecule is it? Remember when we were talking about the four types of local anesthetics that you see, what type would you call this? Bless you. Remember we said we're going to focus on specific categories, right? We talked about the alkaloid derivatives, which cocaine would fall into, miscellaneous compounds, you always have those in drug classes. Then we talked about how we're going to focus on what? So if you had to say what kind of molecule this is, what would you say? It's an ester, yep, so it's a benzoic acid derivative, which is an aniline derivative. So this is a benzoic acid derivative. And this one it was very potent, and it was basically the first substitute that was derived and safe relative to moving away from cocaine. You got to be careful, though, because if anything has the ability to be metabolized, like I said, to pyraminobenzoic acid, then you might have hyposensitivities to it. Shortly thereafter, they synthesized, probably after that, they synthesized about 25 compounds that they developed, and they discovered procaine. We've all heard of procaine, right? Novocaine. Most people think, oh yeah, this is very commonly used. And what do you think it's most commonly used in? What do you think of that? Dentistry, right? But actually, dentistry, they don't use it that much. It's kind of a misnomer. They use xylocaine all the time. They don't use novocaine as much as what people think. But this became the staple for local anesthetics for nearly a half a century. And this is what they used. The potency was not as great as cocaine. It had a shorter duration, it. Not really used as much today, and it has poor absorption through the mucous membranes. So if it has poor absorption through mucous membranes, could you give it topically? No. Okay, so it's not going to be given topically. And its vasodilated properties is what leads to a short duration of action. Another problem with propane is it gets hydrolyzed as you start increasing the pH. So when at lower pHs, it's pretty stable, and you don't see a lot of hydrolyzed amount that gets hydrolyzed. But as you start increasing the dose, you get a lot that starts to get hydrolyzed. And so sometimes you have additives or preservatives being added to try and decrease the amount that's hydrolyzed, because you have to worry about if this dose gets metabolized, for example, at higher pHs, because why? Why would hydrolyzation or the amount hydrolyzed affect anything? What does that affect? Right. If it's hydrolyzed, you don't have an active local anesthetic anymore. So, and that screws up your dosing and trying to figure out how to alleviate pain. So that was one of the drawbacks for this one. Usually given by injection, has lots of different forms. This one has been replaced by lidocaine, or xylocaine is another name for it. We'll talk about that one. Paraminobenzoic acid, so we have to be careful about people that have hypersensitivities to it, or anybody that might be on sildenafil, for example. That we already talked about. We already talked about vasoconstrictors. You guys are all set with this. Okay, then came tetracaine. So after propane, they actually synthesized some more compounds, and they discovered tetracaine. And this one is another benzoic acid derivative, and tetracaine now is going to be much more longer acting than propane was, and it's still a very commonly used local anesthetic. It's going to be relative when you compare it to propane. It's about 10 times more potent, and that's because of this hydrophobic butyl group here. And so, remember, we talked about substitution and the nitrogens here, but this long butyl group is responsible for the reason it's 10 times more potent, because they say, well, maybe there's some sort of a hydrophobic region near the sodium channel that this is binding in very tightly, and so that's the reason that it works so well. But overall, tetracaine is very similar to propane, besides being more potent, and it also increases the duration of action. So tetracaine has about a 4-hour duration versus propane's duration. So you can use this more for longer types of procedures. Now, from a metabolism standpoint, what do you say? Does somebody have the potential to worry about reaction to this? What do you think? Well, when we think reactions, we know we're looking for, does it have the ability to produce something that looks like what? Or is PABA? Does it have the ability to get metabolized to PABA? Yeah, because you can act upon the de-alkylate that amine, and then you can hydrolyze the ester and you'll synthesize PABA very, very quickly and very easily. So you do still have to worry about hypersensitivities to this one. A lot of your side effects that you see with this one is like some dizziness, confusion, but you could potentially see that with any of your local anesthetics. All right, so after tetracaine, they were starting to do some natural products investigation of local anesthetics, and so that's where they came upon the structure of lidocaine, and this is what led to the development of the amide local anesthetics. So pretty much they synthesized, you know, more compounds later, and they figured out after tetracaine, and they found lidocaine. And this was actually when they discovered lidocaine was in 1946, so it's really relatively not that old, but it's still an old drug because lidocaine or xylocaine is what is the number one local anesthetic used in dental practices. This is what they go to. But it gives us a good alternative now because this is an amide derivative, so it's an aniline derivative. see less hypersensitivity to this one, and it's very, very widely used. It falls into the intermediate category acting, and you find lidocaine in almost any form known to man, practically. Like, you can inject it, they have patches, they have nasal sprays, you name it, there's lots of different forms that you can find it in. When you combine lidocaine with a vasoconstrictor, you can increase its duration of action, because one of the problems with lidocaine is it will still cause vasodilation. So if you mix it with epinephrine, you can increase to get a duration of action around 2 hours or so. Okay. So since then, we've synthesized a lot of compounds, but pretty much we've got nowhere, okay? So in the field of local anesthetics, we really haven't come that far. We have some other drugs that we can use. We'll cover those in a minute, but we haven't really discovered a lot. Actually, what's interesting is if you look at the structure of lidocaine, if you take the structure of lidocaine and you do one more substitution on this nitrogen and just add a phenyl group here, you will synthetically make the most bitterest compound known. And they actually use this molecule and they put it into alcohols to make it unfit for drinking. So that's how they can get around governmental control to sell it. And this type of idea of trying to add impurities, if you will, is nothing new. Because if you, have you guys learned about codeine yet in my time? No? Okay. Well, have you learned about schedules? So like if you have pure codeine, it's going to be schedule 2, but you can take codeine and mix it with acetaminophen, and because you're adding impurities, what does that do to the schedule? Pardon? It's a 3, yeah. So you move it to a 3 instead of a 2. So this notion of adding molecules to make things impure is nothing new, but this is actually interesting, as this is the actual molecule that they add to denature alcohol. Since we're talking about lidocaine, it was kind of interesting. All right, we've already talked about all this stuff. Okay. Alright, rapid onset of action lasts for 60 minutes, but this is without basal, or without epinephrine. So if you add epinephrine to it, you can actually get it to last a couple hours. Toxic doses, you're going to be careful about toxic doses with any local anesthetic because of the systemic effects, and it's all dose related. Common side effects you're going to see with a lot of local anesthetics, some dizziness, maybe some confusion, sleepiness, those are very common, not just isolated to lidocaine. Okay, one thing about lidocaine is in addition to its stability and in addition to its decreased hypersensitivity that's seen with this because of the inability to be hydrolyzed to pyrimethamine acid, it does get metabolized to this metabolite though very easily upon hydrolysis, and this one does retain activity, so it's an active metabolite, and so that's what helps increase lidocaine's duration of action. Okay, drug interactions. Beta blockers. Contraindicated with beta blockers because in the effect, it'll reduce cardiac output, hepatic blood flow, which will reduce lidocaine metabolism. You've got to be careful about that, so you just want to kind of avoid it with beta blockers. The second one is Tagamet, and it'll inhibit the hepatic degradation as well, reduce blood flow, very similar to the beta blockers. And so you just want to make sure people are not taking this at the same time as you're getting a local anesthetic because of those effects. We're always concerned with being able to properly metabolize our drugs in the time that we expect it to be metabolized. Anytime you don't have that happening is when the toxicities will be exacerbated and more complications are going to exist. All right, remember when we talked about the mixing of the local anesthetics with molecules like epinephrine and vasoconstrictors, and how we have a couple ones that are not mixed with vasoconstrictors, but lipivacaine is one of them. So this came after. It's another aniline derivative. And it's pretty stable, and it came out pretty much, it's still considered in the intermediate category, and it's very stable, it's potent, etc. And we're going to be able to give this one, it's very similar to lidocaine, but now we can give this one without epinephrine because it has less, fewer toxicities associated with this one relative to lidocaine, and also less vasodilative properties relative to lidocaine. So that's an advantage. So for example, you have someone that has hypertension, okay, and big issues with hypertension. Yeah, you might not want to put them on lidocaine, but you might decide to put them on bupivacaine because that one you can safely give, fewer toxicities, side effects, and you can give it without a vasoconstrictor. So these are great for people that might be on some hypertensive agents, beta blockers, maybe some monoamine oxidase inhibitors, a good alternative for those. The reason why you're going to see bupivacaine used much less frequently than lidocaine is because most people come from the notion of, well, unless, like, I'm really, really concerned about the risk and I don't want to have to, a lot of times you can mix, depending upon where people are, as long as they're not too severe with their hypertensive issues, they're not too worried about mixing it with a vasoconstrictor because the effects are still lower. But, for example, if you have somebody that you really have to worry about, you would put them on bupivacaine. And also, most physicians are like, well, if this is intermediate category, I'd rather give somebody something that gives them more relief. So they are leaning more towards giving somebody a longer-acting medication because it just kind of comforts the patient. It's still used. It's just much less commonly used relative to some of the other agents because of that. But it does have the advantage of being able to use it without a vasoconstrictor. It has a really good duration of action as well. Very safe to use. Actually, it has a better profile than lidocaine. All right. Comes in a lot of different forms. Could you actually take bupivacaine and add it with a vasoconstrictor? Sure. It'll just increase the duration as well. All right, bupivacaine is the first one we're going to talk about that's in the long category acting. So it's a long-acting drug. It'll last for roughly 5 to 6 hours, so that's a lot longer than what we've seen so far. And the reason is because of this piperidine butyl portion, and this is what basically leads to the lipophilicity and the increased potency that you get from using bupivacaine. This is very, when you compare it to its profile, it has a lot of similar characteristics of lidocaine, but this is now a very, very common agent that's used during labor, for example, for epidurals and stuff. Good long-acting local anesthetic. Let's see. Does have some cardiotoxicity associated with it, much more than lidocaine. But if you mix it with epinephrine, the dose is going to be low enough that they're going to be like, well, you're not going to get much cardiotoxicity with it. So typically when they give bupivacaine, they'll mix it with an epinephrine or mix it with epinephrine so that you decrease any sort of cardiotoxicity, and the dose is going to be low enough. But it does have more cardiotoxicity relative to lidocaine. So very fast onset. It'll start working within 10 to 15 minutes, and it'll last for roughly 5 to 6 hours, so much longer than lidocaine. Another common one used in labor is ropivacaine. And so this is another AMED derivative, and this is another long-acting one. This will last pretty close to bupivacaine's duration. It's a little less potent than bupivacaine, but it also has less cardiotoxicity associated with it than bupivacaine. So this would be one that, for example, if somebody has cardiac issues and you want a longer-acting one, you might want to choose this one because it does have less cardiotoxicity and a little greater margin of safety than as compared to bupivacaine. But another very common one used in labor. All right, going back to the benzoic acid derivatives, you have one called 2-chloropropane, and this is a complete descendant of propane. And but it's just, the difference is it's a chlorinated derivative, has a very fast onset of anywhere between 5 and 15 minutes. This is what you want, but it's not going to last a long time, 30 to 90 minutes. It's extremely safe. You're not going to see the cardiotoxicity that we saw, for example, with bupivacaine. You'll see some neurotoxicity, but if you mix it with the vasoconstrictor, that's going to too. So it's overall pretty relatively safe and extremely fast-acting. The other local anesthetic, bless you, that you can give without a vasoconstrictor is prilosec. Remember when we talked about mupivacaine? So that was intermediate acting. Prilosec is also going to be intermediate acting, very similar to lidocaine, but you can give it without a vasoconstrictor. It's potent, like cocaine, and it, this molecule just causes less vasodilative effects. That's why you can give it without it, but also very commonly used. Now, there's lots of ways you can administer your local anesthetics, and you can read through each one of these, and I can do this for you. Most people already know these as of right now, so it's not that big of an issue. We're going to skip through those. You can read those on your own. Okay, there are a number of factors that can influence the effectiveness of an anesthetic. Obviously, nerve fibers can affect the effectiveness of local anesthetics. And did Dr. Holt get into talking to you about like the difference between nerve fibers, whether they're short versus long, and the effects of them, etc.? Did you talk anything about that? Like short nerve fibers versus long nerve fibers, which ones you will usually see first, or which ones you will be acted upon first? What are you saying? Short. pH also affects the effects of an anesthetic, and you, so you got to be careful. Remember, we market the local anesthetics as salts, and so obviously being able to produce the salts are completely pH dependent. And when we talk about procaine, the pH would affect the amount that's going to be hydrolyzed. Alright, we talked about that. Vasoconstrictors, we talked about the advantages of using those. Vasoconstrictors are less effective in prolonging the action, though, of more lipid-soluble drugs, so like your bupivacaine, ropivacaine that we talked about, because why? What are you going to see with your more longer-acting local anesthetics? What, structurally, what do they look like? They're going to be more lipophilic, so what do you expect to have happen with them? Distribution, and also what do you get generally get with a lot of molecules that are very lipophilic? Okay, metabolism, what else? You have redistribution. But protein binding, right? And so protein binding contributes to that. So that's when they're highly tissue bound, then that's going to affect it. So all those things are good things. Vasoconstrictors with local anesthetics. We already alluded to this fact, and we've already talked about this pretty much, so I'm not going to go into it. Vascular areas. Highly vascular areas give more rapid absorption, higher blood levels. So then if you injected it into a poorly perfused tissue, like, for example, your adipose tissue, you've got to be careful. Vascularized areas have a lot of what in the area? Blood flow, right, versus non-vascular areas. Pay attention to metabolism. Pay attention to toxicities. Pay attention to major red flag drug interactions with the drugs. You can separate them pretty much based on whether they're intermediate acting, long acting, when would you want to give one, when would you want to give another. Those are the important things to kind of pay attention to with the local anesthetics. Also know whether, like for example, they have the ability to produce PABA or anything that looks like PABA, because that would lead to a lot of your hypersensitivities that you're going to see with these or not. So a lot of them are very similar, but it depends on what you're looking for. Relative to some toxins, actually I talked to you about these in biochemistry before, tetrodotoxin and saxitoxin. Remember, tetrodotoxin is what comes from the fish, saxitoxin, that's what leads to the red tides. And these are naturally occurring local anesthetics, but they're way too toxic for us to be able to use them clinically. And so we talked about the toxicity effects of them. They actually have very similar mechanisms of action, or the same mechanisms of action of local anesthetics. But we look at them synthetically because actually this is where the research is right now in trying to come up with newer local anesthetics to be able to use in the future. So So sometimes we can actually derive and learn a lot from molecules that work by the same way, but you just can't use them clinically and try and improve upon those. So that's where we're headed for newer local anesthetics in the future. Okay, that's it for local anesthetics. You guys have any questions? Okay, pretty straightforward. We are going to talk about the anti-epileptics now. Fanatical about thimerosal-free vaccines. You can get every vaccine, for example, children need or anybody else needs, in a thimerosal-free form. Physicians will say, oh, please, the concentration is so low that you're not even going to have to worry about it. It's pretty negligible. That's what they say, right? Well, if you look at the research out there, there is clear-cut, unbiased research that shows serious correlations with neurological issues with thimerosal and other mercury-containing products. And so mercury, being a potent neurotoxin, is probably what might have initiated the seizure, right? He might have had an issue with it. But after that, he would have been perfectly fine, probably. 9 out of 10, I would say he would have been fine. So by the time, for example, I was able to talk to them, or even they approached me, they've been taking it for a year and a half. And every time they go back to their physician, the physician increases the dose a little bit. What a complete idiot, right? What would you be saying? Have you had any more seizures, right? Why do you increase the dose? Because you're trying to control seizures, right? If somebody doesn't have another seizure, would you increase the dose? No, this guy, how did he get his medical license? Go to the Virgin Islands or something? I mean, seriously, what a moron, right? So the effects of the antiepileptics are really, like, they will change your life. And some people have a lot of side effects. It's like, for example, my sister-in-law is a dentist, and she, you know, bless her heart, she graduated the top, like, 5% of the class at U of M. She's smart, but I'm the one that got her through, again, chemistry and biochemistry when she was in dental school, and when she was pre-dental. Anyway, we go round and round about amalgam fillings. Guess what amalgam fillings happen now? The day she knows more about chemistry is the day I will trust her on her answer with that. And I always joke with her, and I'm like, who got you for chemistry again? Because she's going to say whatever the ADA wants her to say. For example, there was an old biochemist here. You guys probably didn't know him because he was gone before you guys got here. But anyway, he was in graduate school, and he started coming down with shakes, right? He's like, great, what the heck's going on, right? So he goes to his physician, and they diagnose him as pre-Parkinson's. He's like, great, my life is over, right? So he's like trying to deal with like how this is horrible because he's only like in his late 20s and he's like, this sucks. So he goes to see his advisor, right? Thinking, you know, he's going to tell his advisor, I gotta, you know, I'm sorry, I have to cut back to half time or part time because, you know, it's just diagnosed as pre-Parkinson's, etc. His advisor's like, really? Mike's like, it's not good, you know, I guess. Reaction I was hoping for, but, you know, okay. And so his advisor's like, all right, well, you know, ask him a bunch of questions. And one of the questions came down to, do you have any amalgam fillings in your mouth? And he's like, yeah. He's like, all right, come back and see me tomorrow. He's like, what a fruitcake, you know, what's this guy, where's this guy coming from? So he comes back the next day, and his advisor puts a mercury meter in his mouth. Guess what? It was off the charts, right? Off the charts. They would have evacuated him. And if you think about how, like, amalgam fillings, when they age and how they can crack and how they're a little fill up and they can get into your adipose tissue, concentrations can build up. He didn't realize this at the time, but he appreciated it later, that his advisor just so happened to be one of the top most respected heavy metal experts in our nation. And so he's like, this is what you're going to do. He's like, your physician's a moron. He's like, you're going to go get someone else. And he said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go to as many dentists as it takes until they take all your amalgam fillings out and replace them with porcelain fillings. Then you're going to get on a chelating agent. What's a chelating agent? I taught you this stuff, right? So, specific for mercury. So he was on a chelating agent for probably close to a year. He has some permanent neurological damage, right, because of it. But overall, he's perfectly normal. All his symptoms went away very quickly, and he functioned very well the rest of his life, right? So he's like, you know, and he will give you, I mean, it was interesting to read some of the seriously unbiased research articles out there that show this kind of stuff. His advisor said, yep, if you wouldn't have done that, you would have been in an institution probably in a year, and you would have had no future, you know? So when physicians want to say that they think that they know it all, they don't know it all. My brother-in-law is a physician. He's a urologist, and he is smart. But he'll be the first one to understand that they don't understand the chemistry of it. You know, they're very good at figuring out things and knowing what to do. But, like, they have one semester, very brief semester of biochemistry in medical school. And so, you know, they don't really understand all the aspects of some of the additives that are added to it. So I did spend a lot of time talking to you about something that's not, it's kind of related to epilepsy, but it's very interesting. It's neurotoxic. So anyway, we'll move on. All right, so has Dr. Hull talked to you anything about epilepsy yet? Not yet? Okay, so I will assume you guys don't know anything. The thing with epilepsy, and we're going to talk about it, is you can have different scenarios. You can have some neurons in a localized part of the brain that are seizing. You can have the entire subset of neurons seizing, and it will lead to different kinds of seizures. You have to be able to know what kind of seizures your patient is suffering from before you can put them on adequate drug treatment, because some drugs are just only effective for certain types of seizures. And so, for example, anybody that only experiences one seizure, you don't go put them on an anti-epileptic, right? You guys are never going to make that silly mistake. And you'll always ask your people that are on your anti-epileptics. Actually, if the pharmacist wouldn't talk to him, which was ridiculous, the pharmacist never thought about it, but if the pharmacist would have talked to him, they would have realized this story, because he's very forthcoming about it, and you would have realized this is not a good situation. The pharmacist could have said, why are they increasing your dose, or why are you on this drug? Or sometimes it's good to be nosy, because you will seriously save some people's lives. All right, anticonvulsant versus an anti-epileptic. Not all anticonvulsants are going to be anti-epileptic drugs, and not all anti-epileptic drugs will be anticonvulsants. You need to be able to know whether your seizure is convulsive-type seizure versus not. So, for example, we have absence seizures. Absence seizures are not convulsive-type, and there are drugs that are very effective in controlling absence seizures, which will not be effective at all in controlling convulsive seizures. So, for example, we're going to talk about how kids, often in grade school, that suffer from absence seizure, oftentimes get told that they never pay attention and they just zone out in their own world. Well, that's because a lot of times these kids could be undergoing absence seizures, and we'll talk more about that as we talk about it. You have partial seizures versus generalized seizures. Partial seizures are the most common type of seizures. Generally, if you take, you know, 10 people, 6 or 7 out of 10 people will suffer from partial seizures. And so this partial seizures initially occur in a very localized part of the brain. But the partialized seizures, even though they initially start in a localized region, could eventually spread. And so if they spread, they could eventually move into generalized seizures that affect the entire brain simultaneously. Patients will lose consciousness with generalized seizures, and they usually get convulsions over their entire body. So those are the differences between the two. Now, we can subset partial seizures down based on, are they simple partial seizures, or are they complex partial seizures? And the reason that we do this is because we just said that partial seizures can begin locally and they can start to spread, so it gets more complicated. The biggest difference I want you to know between simple partial and complex partial is that with simple partial, the patients don't lose consciousness. They kind of are fully aware of what's going on while they're seizing. Complex partial seizures, they will lose consciousness. So that's a key distinction between the two. Generalized seizures, we're going to talk about tonic seizures that are very common. Now, Dr. Hull might call these things petite mal seizures. They're not called that anymore. They're called absent seizures, but he might still call them that. I call them absent seizures. This is what they're called in the field of anti-epileptics. talks about all seizures and it's called absent seizures. So they're called absent seizures, but this is like the older name for it. Both of these are very common types of seizures we'll talk a lot about. We also experience, people can experience myoclonic seizures. We'll talk about what this is. And then lastly, febrile seizures. Febrile seizures are the seizures that often occur in little babies and kids, and they're often induced with increased temperature. So we'll talk more about that as we're going to go through each one independently. So simple partial seizures, you don't lose consciousness. You're actually able to, you could be seizing and you could have somebody ask you to do very simple commands like touch your nose or what's going on or what color is this car. They could perform really simple kind of things during their seizure. They respond very, very well to drug therapy though. So that's really good for people that suffer from these. And the seizures don't really last that long. They'll usually last anywhere between 0 and 2 minutes. So they don't last that long. Now the complex partial seizures, remember, you will lose consciousness, and from a time duration, they will last generally about the same as partial. Simple seizures, so anywhere between 0 and up to 2 minutes. But the difference is you're going to lose consciousness. Patients are going to be very tired, confused after the seizure. It wipes out any memory, so they're going to have no recollection of what just happened. They're just going to kind of be disoriented, really confused, tired, etc. And with the complex partial seizures, a lot of these things start out as simple partial seizures, but then they progress into complex partial seizures. Okay. All right. Generalized seizures. So they're called tonic-clonic. Again, an older name is grandma. We don't really call them grandma anymore. We really call them tonic-clonic, but it's just going to be a difference between probably what I'm going to call them and what Dr. Bull's going to call them. Just grandma's the older term used to describe these. And so these things can last 0 seconds up until like 2 minutes. They can actually last longer than 2 minutes. We don't like to see them last longer than 2 minutes because then it becomes really serious. The seriousness of seizures, this is probably your most serious. You will lose consciousness, patients fall to the floor, they can lose bladder control, they can bite their tongue. There have been people that have died because when they got their tonic-clonic seizure, they were, for example, at a party or something, they were eating a hamburger or a hot dog, and then they just immediately had their tonic-clonic seizures and fell down and started seizing. And, you know, most people's reaction is they just freak out, right? And they're like, what's going on, you know, or call 911. But actually, you gotta really think quickly because people will die, and they have died, because they choked to death pretty much because they had food in their mouth at the time. The best thing to do, of course, timing the seizure is when the person falls is to make sure there's nothing around, right? They're perfectly safe. And if you can, possibly move the patient on its side and just kind of take your finger and make sure there's nothing in the mouth. Like, yeah, it's kind of gross, but so what? You could potentially save their life. Because if they have food in there, they could very well choke and die because of it. And after that, make sure you time the seizure, because if it goes beyond 2 minutes, you really have to start worrying because you'll move into what is known as a status situation, which is continual seizing. And so you have to be able to get this under control. It's very, very frightening to watch, but if these seizures last longer than 5 minutes, you could have, the patients could experience a stroke, they could have, you know, a lot of cardiotoxicity issues. I mean, there's lots of things, neurological issues that could result. They could die if it lasts longer than 5 minutes. That's why it's good to time these things, because if they do last longer than 2 minutes, you might want to call like medical personnel if it lasts longer than 2 minutes, because it could progress into a status situation. And there are certain drugs we have that can get that under control right away. Question, Ryan?
Yeah, better seizing command. Not your job.
Oh, yeah.
So you have
they could. Job. Yeah, they could. Yeah, they could. But, you know, if a lot of times you have the opportunity, though, to, if you act pretty quickly before some people do, some people don't. And if you act pretty quickly and you especially turn them on their side, you'll have to make sure their airway and stuff is completely clear. So a lot of times that's not an issue. people freak out and they're like, you know, what the heck's going on and stuff. But there have been people that have died because they have had a seizure and they've been in areas that have been really dangerous, like near rocks, or they could fall over a cliff if they're near that, or they could fall into a pool, like let's say they're near water, and people aren't paying attention and they fall into the water and they seize and they drown. So like, you have to just kind of be diligent, and sometimes it's nice to know if you're surrounded by people that do suffer from epilepsy, because you can just kind of keep an eye on it. All right, so we will, when I talk about the notion of status as we progress, we will come back to this notion of your convulsive or your tonic-clonic status, because there are going to be certain drugs that we're going to give that will control this and get it under control, and we'll talk more about this. Okay, obviously they're going to be confused, they're going to be exhausted, they're going to be very sensitive, tired, exhausted, confused, have no recollection, eventually come out of the seizure. All right, now we have our absent seizures. Remember at the very beginning I said not all convulsions or seizures are convulsive, right? These absent seizures are not convulsive, and they usually begin very early on in age, so anywhere, you know, between 4 years of age and up to 14, 15, 16 years of age. And they involve a brief, abrupt kind of loss of consciousness. And the good thing about absent seizures is that most of the people that have them, 70% of the cases, they will stop. They'll like kind of grow out of them by the time they get to 18 years old. So that's a very good advantage. The problem with absent seizures, though, is you can't interrupt them, okay? So for example, let's go back to the scenario of the kids are in school, right? And the teacher's like, your kid just doesn't pay attention, right? Like, they just are off in Lulu Land and they're not paying attention to anything I'm saying. The problem is sometimes those kids suffer from absent seizures. So for example, there's two different kinds of absent seizures. You can have simple absent seizures where, for example, let's say the student's sitting here and they might be talking and then all of a sudden they just stop and they stare blankly into an area, right? And it might last for 20 seconds, it might last for 30 seconds, it could last up to a minute. And then as soon as, you could be clapping in front of them and be like, Harry, come on, what's wrong with you? Like, let's join the team, let's, come on, start talking, you know? He would not pay attention at all. I mean, he would not know what's going on. Because you can't interrupt that seizure. And then he could be in mid-sentence. And then as soon as the seizure is done, he kind of starts off like nothing ever happened, right? He has no recollection. That's a simple absent seizure. There's also complex absent seizures. So like, for example, he could be sitting there, and all of a sudden, he could just go into his absent seizure, and what you would things that are very common is some little muscle reflexes. So for example, his eyelashes might go like this, you know, for, you know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, very, very quickly. And that's what he's doing when he's undergoing his complex absent seizure. And so there are just differences. And you can't really interrupt an absent seizure, but there are differences between the absent seizures. And the reason I want you to know what absent seizures are is, you know, it's good to know what it is, right, before you treat it. But also, some drugs are only going to be effective. I won't even say some. There are drugs that are only effective for absent seizure. If you give somebody a drug for a seizure that's not absent, it could exacerbate the seizure they have right now, and vice versa. If you give somebody like a convulsive drug to try and treat an absent seizure, it could exacerbate their absent seizures. So you got to make sure that patients are on the right drug, and there's going to be pros and cons for which drug they're going to use. Does that make sense to you? Okay, we're out of time. Have a great day.